Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Michael Clagstead, and I'll be joined on tonight's show with Nicholas Brousseau and Dr. Hope May. We're broadcasting from the catacombs of Anne Spa. We are having some technical difficulties tonight, so things sound a bit weird. Bear with us, and we'll try to get it figured out to get the studio up and running again for the year. Tonight's show will be on the value of thought experiments in ethical inquiry. And the basis for the show, previously, last week's show, a caller sort of asked us, well, what is the benefit of this thought experiment we're doing on the air? I mean, what good does it do? It has no application to real life. Well, that turned out to be a pretty valid question, and we've been talking amongst ourselves, and now we'd like to discuss exactly what value those thought experiments do have, or even if they have a value. Some of us may argue that they are rather unhelpful. So on that note, I guess we'd just like to define what a thought experiment is. Could you help me out with that, Nick?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. A thought experiment is a hypothetical that can apply to a particular real-life issue hypothetically.
So if we had to give an example, I mean, last week I brought up the trolley car problem, and that's what threw us into this mess. And essentially, especially in moral problems or ethical questions, oftentimes we're discussing issues that we can't always point to in real life. Or I guess you should say this isn't the sort of science where we can, you know, throw chemicals together and see what happens. To do an experiment, sometimes we have to pretend, you know, and then figure it out from there. So in the case of the trolley car problem, the person being questioned, the victim of the thought experiment, is given a scenario, and then they're asked sort of how they would respond, right? Given these sets of circumstances, what would you do? Or given this set of preconditions, what would we expect to happen? That's sort of where we're going with the thought experiment.
Right, and so because these preconditions, we can't just, you know, put our brains inside the matrix and recreate some sort of experience. We just have to imagine what we would do in the experience that would be the morally correct action, provided that we're doing using the thought experiment for some ethical question. Is that fair to say?
Right. A real-life matrix might certainly render the thought experiment useless, but since we don't have one, we'll stick with good old-fashioned Aristotelian thought experiments.
Can you guys hear me?
Absolutely.
Actually, I don't know if you want to do it now, but we do have a clip of the trolley problem.
Yeah, rather than me blundering through it, why don't we just put that on the air?
Okay, so this is actually a clip from a class at Harvard, Michael Sandel's class on justice. You could actually watch the class in its entirety online, and we've put a link to it at our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu, under show resources. And this is a very large class. There's probably a couple hundred students in it. And what I've done with this clip is I've edited some parts of it out and put some things together. But after asking the class the trolley problem question, he takes a poll, and most people in the class raise their hand to save the five people rather than the one, and then he asks them another class. So this is about a two-minute clip, and this is the trolley problem, Michael Sandel at Harvard University.
Suppose you're the driver of a trolley car, and your trolley car is hurtling down the track at 60 miles an hour, and at the end of the track you notice five workers working on the track. You try to stop, but you can't. Your brakes don't work. You feel desperate because you know that if you crash into these five workers, they will all die. Let's assume you know that for sure. And so you feel helpless until you notice that there is, off to the right, a sidetrack. And at the end of that track, there's one worker working on the track. Your steering wheel works. So you can turn the trolley car, if you want to, onto the side track, killing the one, but sparing the five. Here's our first question. What's the right thing to do? What would you do? Let's consider another trolley car case and see whether those of you in the majority want to adhere to the principle, better that one should die so that five should live. This time you're not the driver of the trolley car, you're an onlooker. You're standing on a bridge overlooking a trolley car track. And down the track comes a trolley car. At the end of the track are five workers. The brakes don't work. The trolley car is about to careen into the five and kill them. And now, you're not the driver. You really feel helpless until you notice, standing next to you, leaning over the bridge, is a very fat man. And you could give him a shove. He would fall over the bridge, onto the track, right in the way of the trolley car. He would die, but he would spare the five. Now, how many would push the fat man over the bridge? Raise your hand.
Okay, so that was a clip from an actual class at Harvard, Michael Sandel's class on justice. Again, you can watch the entire class online. I think there's actually 12 different segments to it. So, Mike, you want to pick up with that?
Yeah, Sandel kind of presented us with Judith Jarvis Thompson's formulation of the trolley car problem, which she discusses in detail in several articles, I believe, and I think even in a book. So if you're more interested, check her out. She does a lot of discussion on the trolley car problem. But the basic idea, as Professor Sandel shared with us, is that the person undergoing the thought experiment has a choice. Kill one person to save five? Well, as he reveals, he's sort of sampling the class for a majority to see what they think. As he toys with the thought experiment, the number of people willing to kill the man to save the five changes. I guess what he realizes in the class is that people aren't as willing to sacrifice one man when they have to do the dirty work themselves. That's not so important to our show right now, but the idea, and he illustrates this really well behind a thought experiment, is to sort of mess around with variables and figure out what it is that is making us answer in a given way. It's sort of... I guess it really allows philosophers and others to pick apart the motivations behind why people do what they do. And I guess that's just one of the most common uses of a thought experiment. Is there anything else we want to say about the trolley car problem before we move on?
Not me.
Well, provided that a lot of people answer a particular question of what the trolley, you know, do you kill the five workers or change the direction and hit the path of the man?
Mm-hmm.
Provided that a large number of people choose one way, then you kind of get an idea of what people's intuitions are.
Exactly.
about a particular thing.
Exactly.
Which I think is useful, and then you kind of have to work to flesh out the reasons behind such intuitions, if there are any, and maybe they're culturally based. You know, it would be interesting to use in different cultures and see how those people did it. So I think it does, can offer something in that regard.
Right. One of the most common artifacts of humanity that is illustrated by these types of thought experiments is the harm-benefit asymmetry. Most times, in order to do the dirty work, so to speak, in order to make someone say they'd be willing to harm someone else, the benefit that is returned has to be exceedingly great, if that makes sense. In the case of the trolley car problem, if you ask a group of people, same scenario, a trolley car is going to run into two people, but you can switch the track and kill one person, they're far less likely, the percentage majority changes greatly, than if you make it 10 people if that makes sense. There seems to be some sort of mental calculus we do when we answer these questions, and the benefit to harming someone has to be great. That's just I don't even know what to call it. That's just a little piece of human psychology there, harm-benefit asymmetry. Anyway.
Well, do you want to say something, Nick?
No, thank you.
Well, I mean, I agree that these thought experiments help to tease out our intuitions about these various permutations on the problem. But, and I guess this raises the deeper question of why we engage in ethical philosophy in the first place. Why do we do philosophy regarding ethics? And I'll just throw out there that, you know, it could be the case that when we're sitting in the calm of a classroom and prompted by specific questions that are really causing us to focus on certain aspects of a situation that we're not directly in because we're sitting in a classroom, that like that activity, while very interesting, may not actually have an impact, right? It may not trickle down to one's actual behavior when one has to make a moral decision. So I guess I want to say that, I guess I'll ask the question to both you, Nick and Mike. Do you think that talking about these different permutations of a thought experiment and teasing out our intuitions does have a trickle-down effect on one's behavior?
Well, if I may, philosophers like Thompson, I think I can definitely call Thompson a philosopher,
mm-hmm.
I think are not so much interested in helping people make ethical decisions as much as they are interested in, like, meta-ethics and figuring out, you know, what it is that makes people tick. I think that, like, the trolley car problem is probably more interesting to, like, social psychologists and these type of people than it is to somebody who signs up because they want to make ethical decisions. I think that that's not exactly what that's geared to. But if I may, I don't think this is a perfect response. It's not tailored exactly to the question that you're asking. But we use hypotheticals to practice for real life all the time. I mean, what I would use as an example of what I'm speaking of, stop, drop, and roll. You know, we do this with our children all the time.
Who?
In school, we always practice this. At least I did in grade school. I don't know about you, Nick.
I didn't practice it, but I definitely know the saying, and I was told
right.
it many a time.
Exactly.
So,
hypothetically speaking, if you were to catch fire, what should you do? Well, stop, drop, and roll. I mean, it's in my mind. Now, Dr. May is pretty young, so I think she probably did
probably
that in school,
told her
too.
To stand up and run around
right,
and yell
yeah,
for
right.
help.
I think that's before my time.
Okay, well, anyway, I think this is the mantra of, you know, fire safety in middle schools and elementary schools. That's what you do if you catch fire. Let me give you another example. I don't have children of my own, but I've certainly been privy to conversations where mom and dad sit down the kids and say, should this happen, what will we do? You know, should the house catch fire, what should you do? And then the family sort of makes a game plan. Or if a stranger talks to you, what should you do? You start screaming wildly and look for a policeman.
Okay, well, if I may I? See, those are different because in those cases we're not faced with a dilemma, right? It's like if there's a fire, what, like it's an if-then statement. If there's a fire, then what do you do? It's not we have to choose between, you know, the lesser of two evils. So I would say that in those situations, there's clearly like a bad thing and there's clearly a rational response, whereas in like thought experiments, typically it's a variety of bad things. Actually, I would classify it as Joseph Badaracco does in his book Defining Moments, that you have what he calls a right decision. So there are right-wrong decisions. So in the trolley problem, if there is a person on one track and nobody on the other track, clearly it's morally wrong to put the train on the track which is directed towards the person, right? But it's it's less clear what you should do if there's one person versus five. So I would just say that indeed we ask these questions if there's a stranger that comes up to you, what do you do? But I would say that they're logically different because they don't involve the kind of dilemma where we're forced to choose between two values.
Well, so provided that you combine the two that he was using and said, you know, provided the house goes on fire stranger outside, should you speak to strangers and violate the rule? You know, and I think your intuitions as a child, if you knew the two principles, you might be able to tweeze that out. But would you have been able to do that anyway? And are you really learning anything through the thought experiment anyway? Or are you just following up on your intuitions?
Well, I think given more time, I'd have a better response. But this is sort of my first attempt, shoot from the hip. In the same scenario, mom and dad sitting down with the family, what should you do if the house catches fire? I mean, we can make that a right decision or a wrong decision. Should you grab your trunk of Pokemon cards or should you grab your little sister? Okay.
No, I think that's a right wrong decision.
Okay, clearly. But look, now we can easily adjust this and we can say, should you go make sure mom's okay,
sure,
or should you grab your little sister?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it becomes more complicated.
Sure. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. So that's all I'm saying, that like the example that you gave, the hypotheticals were not of that nature. Now they are. And now, yeah. And so right, these in ethics at any rate, these thought experiments involve these values that we must choose between or among in some cases. And right, so if we're sitting down at the table and we say, okay, the house is on fire and you can save, like, you have two dogs and you both love them. You can only, this is the Sophie's Choice problem, right? You can only save one dog. Which do you save? What's the right dog to save?
But let's say, you know, we choose between Spot and Spike. You know, these are our two choices. And we sit down and have a rational discussion. Well, Spike is 11 years old and Spot is 2 years old.
Mm.
Spike's most, you know, likely on the outs. He's got hip dysplasia, these sorts of things. Then you decide as a family, you know, that, well, if anybody's got a chance, you're going to grab Spot first. And I'm not saying that this really makes sense, you know. I'm sure Joe's going to call in and say, what the heck are you talking about?
What if they're the same age?
Okay, but...
see, this is what I'm saying. We could do this, right?
I'm not denying that thought experiments in some circumstances are certainly banal. I mean, it happens. But on the other hand, you know, it is certainly possible that given a thought experiment and having done it, you may be ready to make a tough decision and then not regret it later. Chances of that happening, I don't know. You know,
does that ever happen to any of you?
No, but one of the things that my stepdad always does, and he's a black belt in karate, and he talks about when you're walking down the street and you see a group of guys walking down, say you're with you know, this pretty girl and you're kind of in a rough part of town, he goes, I'm always sizing people up, you know, and I'm always saying, you know, just kind of looking at people's posturing and trying to make a decision about what would I do if I were to have to be defending myself against this group of guys, you know, provided this guy is really big and he seems to have kind of just like a leadership role amongst this group. Perhaps I go for him first and I punch him in the throat and then his other guy, you know, break his knee. Whatever, he's going through his head, and I guess he's doing a thought experiment that in some sense could be beneficial and trickle down into real life action, even though it's a thought experiment going on inside his head.
I mean, I guess I would say, should we distinguish between thought experiments on the one hand and what's called practical deliberation on the other? Right? So thought experiments typically are far removed. You're sitting in a classroom, right? They're hypothetical. Whereas in this case, right, your stepfather is clearly faced with this, to use
well,
a legal term.
Actually, no, okay. Because he's bringing this up to me as something that I almost should be doing.
Okay, but
so,
I thought you were saying when he's walking.
But but he would be doing it. But I guess I may have said that. But in the context, he's telling me that you know, you might want to be thinking about these things.
Okay.
But far removed is one of the things of a thought experiment, and what else? I'm just trying to tweeze out what you're saying here experiment between practical deliberation versus thought experiment.
Right. So with practical deliberation, the way that I understand it, not that I know anything, is okay. So there's, you know, like, Aristotle makes this distinction. distinction between theoretical reason, which is like the sort of meta-ethical inquiry that we're talking about, and we want to understand like the theoretical basis of some concept, where practical deliberation is you're faced with, you know, a concrete situation, and there are clear factors that are relevant, okay? And I think we started to do this last week with the trolley problem when I brought up the question, well, does it matter if you know the people on the track, right? So when you do practical deliberation, those relevant factors, are, I would say, are more part of the deliberative process, whereas thought experiments, how they're traditionally done, those factors may be brought in through the discussion, but at least with Michael Sandel's case, he asks the question, and then he's like, okay, sure, raise your hand, which one you would do. So there's a more, the terrain of the hypothetical, right, because you're not actually walking down the street. Your stepfather's saying, if you were walking down the street, here are the factors that you should consider.
Right, so it's almost like we're back at the stop, drop, and roll thing. It's the same.
Yeah, I feel that's before my time, and you know, I don't know what that means. For me, it was, where's the fallout shelter? But anyway, I'm serious. Go to the fallout shelter. But no, I think that there's a difference, and you know, do you guys see a difference there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the distinction you're drawing there is a fair one. I don't know that it's always that clear, though. I think I would sort of pull out some Aristotle and say that they're opposite ends of the same spectrum, and you know, that maybe the distinction. You know, I guess we discussed this before the show. I would just say it's the abstract end, the theoretical end versus the practical end. Mm-hmm. I see them as different ends of the same thread myself.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that, you know, so long as one is doing thought experiments and keeping in mind, like, there are relevant factors that, right, do you know the people on the track, or how old is one of the dogs, like these sorts of things, that's good. But then we can still raise the question, like, even if they're both part of, you know, they're different ends of the same spectrum, and let's suppose we do these things and we get, like, you sit down with your stepfather, like, every night and, you know, and he gives you, like, all these different scenarios. So, okay, what if, like, one guy has a knife or whatever it is? And, like, what if you don't know the girl that well? No, I'm kidding. But anyway, like, then the question is, like, when you're in the, and if we're going to pull out Aristotle, here's Aristotle, like, when you're in, like, the heat of the moment, okay, and whatever, the adrenaline turns on and whatever, and, like, the girl starts screaming, like, is all of that going to come back to you? And I don't think there's, like, clear answer yes or no, but I think that's a fair question to ask, right? Because I think one also has to say, it's very easy for us to say when you're in the situation, do X, Y, and Z, but then when you're actually in the situation and you have, like, your emotions and all the stuff kicking in biochemically, that your reason and, like, all of this deliberation that you've done is actually going to impact that. I think it can, but I don't think it necessarily will.
I would absolutely agree with that. And, I mean, the example that I've kind of been talking about with friends is, you know, somebody walks into a place, like shooting a place up, you know, and suppose you're close to the guy. You'd like to think that you would jump up and try to take the guy out, you know, that was shooting the place up. But in the heat of the moment, what's really going to happen, you know? And it seems to be the case that most people are like, I don't know what I would do. You know, I would like to think that I would do this. And that seems to be the, at least the consensus that I've gathered from the people that I've talked to. So yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You asked if we, either of us, had any real-life application of the thought experiment. I guess parallel to Nick's story, a little different because it doesn't involve physical altercations. I often ask myself, you know, when I see something go haywire in real life, I guess I'll just make up a story. Let's say my friend Scott has plagiarized on a term paper, and I have a feeling he's going to get caught. When things like this happen to me in real life, I'll very often ask myself, okay, given he approaches me and asks me to cover his butt, what will I do? Given the professor comes to me and asks, do I know anything about it, what will I do? In those circumstances, I'd say thought experiments are extremely useful because while, you know, only one of those things may actually happen, if I've prepared myself for a multitude, you know, I stand a better chance of not regretting my decision later,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And those could very easily be wrong choices where there is no great answer. There's just one that's better than another, and you have to sort of flesh it out to make it happen. But I do think you're right when you made this distinction between the theoretical thought experiment and the practical deliberation, you called it. I do think that people who are partaking in thought experiments are often looking for something different than practical deliberators. Case in point, Thompson. I don't think she's really looking for an answer to the trolley car problem as much as she is trying to learn about human psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true or not. I think it is, though.
And I would also say, like, it's not so much a thought experiment, but, you know, the Kitty Genovese, the Genovese phenomenon,
right.
where, you know, you see something happening and something bad happening and nobody does anything. I do think, like, even though the, you know, social psychologists may look at this, social psychologists tend to want to say, well, this is like a bad response. So, like, with the Genovese syndrome, for instance, people will say things like, well, that needs to be corrected.
Mm.
So it could be the case that we're getting at the human psyche and how it will resolve this problem, and then we may think, well, there's something wrong with that, and we may want to intervene and try to come to some better solution, whatever that would look like. But I want to go back also to, if I may, to Joe Badaracco's part about right decisions. And I also want to say something that he points out that I think is extremely valuable. And going back to your scenario with your friend and the plagiarism and all of that, what Badaracco says is when we're faced with these dilemmas, these right decisions or wrong, however you want to describe it, it's wrong to think of these decisions in a vacuum. That it's not just like you have to make this decision and such is the right answer, that the right answer really depends on, like, who you want to become. And that's a question that you must ask yourself at the beginning, really, of your moral development. Like, who do I want to become and what values do I really want to stand for? And what Badaracco says, which is so interesting, is that we really, instead of being sort of like arrested by these decisions, right? Because you could be in this situation and go like, I don't know what to do. And typically people, when they're in a situation like that, which causes a great deal of discomfort, they just freeze. They just go like, whatever, let fate take its course.
Mm-hmm.
And other people will make a decision based on other reasons. But what Badaracco says is like, the correct way really depends on this metaphysical nature of the self and the fact that we are creating ourselves, and we have to look at this situation as like a means. It goes back to something that you said a few weeks ago, Nick, about philosophy being like a tool, that we have to look at this dilemma as a tool that we can use to get us closer to who we want to be. And so, like, the right answer or the right response is that response which gets us closer to who we want to be. So maybe, like, you want to be the person who, you know, just outs everybody who plagiarizes, and that's, like, your core value. Or maybe you just want to be, like, a really good friend. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So it depends on who you want to be, and I think that when we isolate thought experiments apart from this fact about identity and that we're always becoming, we pay short shrift to thought experiments. I think they can be made much more rich if we embed them in that context of becoming.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, so becoming, and this is what he said would be the first thing that you would do then when you engage in a thought experiment. It's like, so what do you want to become?
It's like the tombstone question.
So is it like the tombstone question in the sense that it's almost like it's just a single value or a very narrow, I don't want to say narrow, but low, I don't know.
Focused,
mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. a very particular thing, and how is it best going to be served through this environment?
Mm-hmm.
I think the obstacle for the thought experiment there, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think it's almost good advice for a day-to-day ethical wayfarer. Good advice, who do you want to become? I think this is actually probably a more honest description of what Thompson tries to do in her paper. I think the barrier to including identity is that most people who, especially in philosophy, talk about thought experiments are looking for an objective theory of morality, which is, in other words, something totally separate from identity, something that's not influenced by who you are or subjective circumstances. Now, whether that makes thought experiments less useful, probably, in the practical deliberation sense, it probably does. But I think that's contrary to Thompson's goals there. I think that's a better example of what she's doing. She's probably not doing social psychology as much as she is trying to formulate an objective theory of ethics.
Which, I just have a problem with the idea of an objective theory of ethics. I mean,
in the
not only as hard as is objectivism within the context of science, but then when you bring it into aesthetics or ethics, I think it becomes extremely problematic trying to bring, I guess, like nice cut and dry mathematics, basically, into the context of ethics. It just seems, not a good thing to do.
Yes. We've had several shows on the International Criminal Court, and we've talked about things like genocide. And I am still reading the book by Amartya Sen. We played his clip a couple weeks ago. And it's a really great book, The Idea of Justice. It's right there, actually. but he makes the point that, when we're talking about objectivity, I don't know if you remember this, the question that he was asked was about objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And the interviewer said, hey, you make a big to-do about objectivity regarding justice. And if you have two reasonable people and they have reasonable disagreements, how do you know which one is right? And he doesn't really answer the question very well there, but in his book at least, he says, well, instead of focusing on the disagreement, let's focus on the agreement, because we clearly do agree. Certain things are bad and should be done away with. And instead of, Sen's whole approach and the idea of justice is, instead of focused on being focused on, these ideal archetypes of, the just society, what William James calls the classical world of the philosophy professor, right, this classical architecture of these abstract types, instead of being focused on, the perfectly just society, let's be focused on, the problems that exist and what we need to do to eliminate them. So I'm just saying, in order to talk about objectivity, we can still talk meaningfully about it, even though there's disagreement.
Right. I mean, and I would agree with that. I guess what I was saying is, I just think about Kant's categorical imperative, which is this idea that there are these single principles within the moral realm of understanding, for example, that one should never lie, and then the circumstance comes up, well, suppose that you're, back in World War II and you're hiding Jews in your house and some Nazis come up and ask you if you're hiding any Jews in your house.
That's a thought experiment.
Right. it's a thought experiment to illustrate that there's not really an objective, that to say that lying's wrong all the time doesn't seem to be the case. And perhaps that that's a useful place for a thought experiment to go, to kind of disprove holding on to these big general principles that are supposed to be all encompassing and always true and absolute.
What I hear you saying, Nick, and correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of like, look, objective morality sounds all fine and good, but it never actually works. And given that we've taken basically, I think, every ethical theory class offered at Central together, I'm inclined to agree that, these pursuits at objective theories of morality usually do fail for one reason or another. They have some sort of inconsistency or they conflict with some value we have. And I'll agree with that. They do usually fail. But at the same time, I won't speak for him. Maybe he'll call in and correct me. I believe Dr. Rousseau said something in concurrence with this, I still have this intuition that an objective theory of morality is like the thing to have. Now, even if it's unachievable, I mean, I don't know, I'm still going to fight you on that one. It's at the very least very difficult, yes. It has not yet been achieved to great satisfaction of the philosophy group.
I mean, if I were to get really spacey here, I would say that we're not even in the right way of even thinking or the right way of even doing things to even begin to approach something that would resemble that. That's just my opinion, which is bounded on nothing.
We as a society or
we as in Western rationality.
Oh, okay.
We as in Western rationality.
Okay, could you get
so.
More spacey, please?
I could. Hey, man, like, there's this dude, and he's, like, all about right things.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, for real. What? So, if I understand this debate, if I may, even though we may not be able to achieve objectivity in ethics, it's something worth shooting for? What you're saying?
Yeah, I'll jump on board with that all day long. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And your response, Nick, is granted, but we're not shooting for it?
I think that what we're shooting at is something far removed from what it would be.
What, we're missing the mark.
Yeah, we're missing the mark by a long shot.
What should we be should we be aiming at?
I don't know. I mean, if you couldn't tell if you've been listening to this whole show and hearing me, it doesn't sound like I'm really presenting any particular view because I guess I don't really have one other than, you know, advanced ethics at CMU I did not enjoy because going over these thought experiments, for example, very in-depth into the trolley problem, where to the point where it seems just so far removed from what anything is – anything real, you know, anything that could actually happen, and you may have felt that listening to the I couldn't really hear the clip so well, but I'm pretty sure it's that they push the fat man off the mm-hmm. bridge so he stops the train from.
No, they don't want to. Well, the class doesn't want to.
The class doesn't want to.
They feel but, like they're getting involved. Then
they can't do the dirty work.
But really, like you're gonna be like, do you ever see yourself on a bridge where there's a train coming? There's a fat man. I mean, it's just silly. The one in the cave where there's a bunch of them that are just, they're just absurd,
so,
at least in my mind.
So I hear you saying that to be, like, aimed, the better thing to be aimed at is something that would be, like, more concrete and more applicable. Is that what you're saying?
I would hope so, yeah. But I don't really know that I would have to think about it more, I guess, or perhaps do more. I've seen more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was saying this at the beginning of the show, and I was talking about the devastation. You know, if Haiti wasn't enough, now we have Pakistan to deal with. And for those of you who do not know, Pakistan is basically completely underwater. The whole country is in dire straits. There's people who have lost everything, you know, and it's like a whole country of people who have lost everything. Strategically, this is not good for the United States because the Taliban is there, so it's hard for relief aid organizations to get in there. And I can tell you that as I hear about this more and more, it bothers me. And I don't know, like, I feel, like, guilty being here. And maybe this is making no sense, but... maybe what you're getting at, perhaps, if I may throw this out, is like this is the kind of real conundrum that we're faced with, right? I feel guilty and I need to do something, but it's like my education has not given that to me. Maybe education shouldn't give that to you. Maybe education should just be about job training, or maybe education can't give that to you. Okay, I'll ask Mike since you've been quiet. Playing with some object over there. What's your response to all this?
The Pakistan being underwater?
No, the whole, like, what Nick is saying is make it more applicable, and my example of that is, okay, here's, like, something that's in our lives now. At least with me, maybe you don't really care, but for me, I feel bad about it. And so the question is, okay, if education, or at least ethics education, should help me deal with that feeling that I have and negotiate it, what would it involve if not thought experiments?
Yeah, interestingly enough, this is what comes to mind, again, not a direct response, but I'm sure that both Nick and Dr. May are familiar with Peter Singer, and hopefully some of our listeners are too. But he actually answers a question sort of like this. He starts out with thought experiments in his different papers. Some of them are about, like, speciesism and why we should be vegetarians, and others are about relief aid in other countries. But essentially what he tries to do in his different papers is, look, here's this tragedy, and he convinces you that it's bad. He convinces you that you not doing anything about it is wrong. And he's pretty successful. He's one of the more compelling authors I've read. And then, at the end of the paper, he, you know, will post a link to a website or something and say, this is what you can do about it. So there certainly is that approach. One is just donating money, you know, that's what you could do about it. But explaining how ethics should help you deal with that situation, I think, is a very difficult task.
I agree.
If one feels as Dr. May does, check out Peter Singer, and he'll definitely convince you to go hermit and save Pakistan.
But see, here's the other thing I want to say about that. Like, and, you know, the Greeks were obsessed with this problem of akrasia, right, which is weakness of will. That is, and we're all afflicted with it. You know what the right thing to do is, and you know you should do it, but you don't. So it could be like, yeah, you know, I read this great book. It has a total action plan laid out. You know, here's the 10 steps. You know, here's like the local organization that you can call up and work with. And I'm going to say, yeah, like I watched Food Inc. I don't know if you guys have seen that. Given like what's happening with eggs and beef, you should check it out. I told you. Okay. But at the end of Food Inc., it's the same thing. Like, they say, like, here's this website, and, you know, I didn't go onto the website. So what I'm trying to say, since we brought up Aristotle, is, like, when we're talking about ethics, it's that turning point between, okay, I know that this is what I should be doing, so one question is, how do we get to that knowledge, thought experiments, or one method by getting to, like, okay, what should I do? But then there's this other part of the equation of, okay, execution. And it's not the case that even if I know what the action plan is and it's right in front of me, that I'm going to do it. And so my question is, going back to Nick's thing, I think, Nick, if I may, like, that's what we mean by, like, really applicable, because that's something that we're all faced with. Everybody is faced with this weakness of will, and can you, through education, deal with that? Or does that involve, I mean, education in the sitting in a classroom sense, or does this involve something completely different, like you were saying, Nick, we're
looking
at the wrong thing?
Right. In my opinion, I think it takes something different than being in a class and just you know, using your intellect. And I think this goes to something that I was kind of describing before the show, is that although I didn't enjoy my advanced ethics class a whole lot, again, for reasons that I already said, but it can be kind of fun, at least as a philosophy student, working through arguments, even if they are arbitrary, you know, and not relevant to anything. It's like, oh, this is kind of fun, like, you know. And So you can just use your intellect in, I guess, almost arbitrary ways, you know, and just kind of, like, go down into, you know, Alice in Wonderland and play around in there for a while and, you know, see what you end up at. And, you know, it's a big green dinosaur, and you're like, cool, here we are.
Well, clearly, if I may chime in, too, it is something different because, actually, you know, selling your possessions and going to Pakistan and, like, handing out life rafts is clearly not a thought experiment. That's clearly not an exercise of intellect in the way that we're talking about. That's an exercise of will.
And I would say it's also an exercise of practical reason. Sorry. So I would say it is intellect because there's, like, you know, a decision being made, right? So it's practical reason.
Yeah, I don't know, to answer your question, I don't know if that can be taught. You know, if it could be taught, I'm sure there would be people teaching. Once I realize what's right, what should I do about it? But I know in my own life, I don't know if this is helpful or an answer, or maybe I'm just babbling, so if it becomes that, let me know. I think this gets back to the tombstone question and the question of you were talking about earlier. What does one want to become? Mm-hmm. You know, how should I handle this wrong choice or this right choice? It's a question of who I want to become. Mm-hmm. I feel just as, you know, compelled and moved as the next person when I think in moral problems, the circumstance we were faced with back in my freshman year, Dr. Noggle told us about this paramecium, which essentially, I won't go into detail, but it lives, you know, in various large rivers, and it tears out the eyeballs, sort of, people that swim in the water. It turns their eyelashes in and scratches their eyes until they can't see. Anyway, the vaccination for this paramecium to give to African children is like $1.25, so the cost of like a Coke bottle, 20-ounce Coke. You could, you know, be vaccinating children. And there are websites. You can just Google it and pay for children to be vaccinated and see the results and everything. So the question becomes, why am I not doing this? Well, I'm definitely up at nights. There are times, you know, why am I not doing this? And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I've donated $20. There are times when I just can't stand it and I've got to do something about it. But in my own life, I guess I would just say, I don't know about philosophy in general, but in soul searching and figuring out the tombstone question, what do I want to become? The answer I've arrived at is that, you know, I don't want to change the world. It's not my aspiration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not saying you have to. I'm not saying ethical action involves changing the world.
No, absolutely not. I guess I would just say the dilemma is solved for me by purpose searching. Does that make sense?
No.
I think it does.
Purpose searching, I mean, like,
maybe my aspiration is to build a beautiful cathedral, and while I'm still, you know, concerned with the lives of...
No, that's great. And what I'm saying is you could, like, answer your tombstone question, and you want to, you know, glorify God, and the means by which you do that is building, you know, this beautiful cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, like, really, really, really clear to you.
Mm-hmm.
But you never start. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something entirely different. I guess what I would say is that people who have this problem, there's all these flooding going on in Pakistan, I just can't do anything about it, or I'm not going to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just internalizing purpose. I mean, if someone really feels that, I'm not giving a tutorial here or a 10-step guide or a how-to or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but as you said, you know, it's a lack of will, it's a lack of internalization. Yes, this is a problem. Am I really going to throw everything away and do something about it? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think what we're talking about is two different things. And so, like, the whole thought experiment, like Judith Jarvis Thompson versus Peter Singer approach. So you have, like, the action plan, and, like, that's an improvement because then you're given, like, actual concrete steps. But then the question that is raised is, okay, even if I have the actual concrete steps, there's still this other problem of execution. And that's really where, like, for me, this is my view of ethics. Like, when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about behavior. Like, meta-ethics, different thing, but when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about behavior. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's why we're concerned about it. That's why there's this proliferation in classes on ethics, because, and I think it's every generation goes, oh, my God, you know, the world is going down the toilet. And the response, at least in our generation, is more ethics classes. Like, especially in the business world where there's all these problems, like with Wall Street and whatnot, oh, there should be more ethics classes in business. And so...
more thought experiments.
So what I'm saying is there could be, like, you know, and I don't even think business ethics classes lay out these action plans like Peter Singer does or like Food Inc. does. But even if they... and that would be an improvement. But even if they did, there would still be this further thing of execution, and that's something that we should also be concerned with. And I think it's worthy of discussion at any rate, like how, if at all, we can move that.
Well, okay, so what? How much time do we have left?
11 minutes.
So, Hope, let me ask you, you know, as being a professor for quite a few years now, like what...
Only a couple. I am younger than
what
you.
Yeah, but you... correct me if I'm wrong, but about 15 years, right?
Oh, yeah, longer than that.
Okay, so quite a while. And, I mean, although, you know, turning in a paper, a quality paper, may not be, you know, so much value-driven as, you know, going to Pakistan and giving life rafts to people, What do you, how do you give, or how do you see students either motivating themselves? You know, maybe you can give us a little spectrum of people why they end up executing to do a particular thing.
Well, I just
we can start there, maybe.
Okay, I'm going to answer your question by avoiding it.
That's
typical
cool.
Technique that, yeah. That professors use. But I'm not really avoiding it. I'm sort of like coming at
moving.
It from a different angle, if you will. But I have to say, like, this is something, even though I am, you know, old and I've been teaching for more than 15 years, and I've been doing philosophy for a long time. I mean, since high school, quite frankly. That's when I had my first philosophy class. I'm still becoming who I want to be. And that's,
do you think that that's reachable?
No, I think it's a lifelong process.
Okay.
I think it's a life. I think that you should die, like, trying to. Like, when you die, you should be aiming at something that you don't yet have. That's my goal. But I can tell you that, this is something that I am faced with currently in my life. The Pakistan, packing up and going to Pakistan or somewhere else, it's not as far away from a decision as you may think it is. But you see, there's also something to be said for writing books and leaving things for future generations, right? And it's something that maybe you can do both. And it's something that I am currently wrestling with. I think that when I share that with students, and when students hear about my own failures and my own challenges, that I'm faced with the same existential, metaphysical problems that you are, that's comforting in a way. And that's my answer. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Did I answer your question?
I think you came at it from a different different angle.
Are you asking, like, what I do practically?
I guess I was just trying to tweeze out, and I don't know if we're even thinking about it in the right way, kind of the same problem that I was saying about coming up with an objective.
I do volunteer my time for certain local time and talent and skills that I have for certain local organizations and projects that I think are important. So right now for me it's, like, quite local. So I do things like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just asking, like, how do you, and maybe, maybe this isn't a very important question, maybe we can just move on, but how does it, how do you get somebody to go off and execute something? It seems like, to me at least, I'll go ahead and try to answer my own question, to try to get somebody to execute something that, it has to come from them, whatever it is. And secondly, I think that thing of whatever it is has to be value-driven, like we were saying, it's about figuring out that purpose or, who you're going to become kind of thing. And in part, these business ethics classes, as you were talking about, that don't really, the world's going to hell, so let's make more ethics classes as if it will fix something. In terms of the people that I see within the university environment, we're supposed to be the elite, and I just don't see that kind of value being portrayed by a majority of the students.
Hmm.
I don't know if I really. I'm sorry, I kind of rambled there, but yeah, just to recap, execution, I think, involves value, having some sort of value, and that it comes from you and not from a particular class.
Yeah, and I also want to say, however, that I've been experimenting with, teaching techniques. I'm still, like, every semester I do something different. Every person's different, and some people may need, there's the metaphor of the carrot and the stick, and some people, like, may need the stick. And, like, they want it, They, like, want, like, the harshness to come down on them. And, like, they need it because, like, in their life they've never had. I can tell you that for me, that is exactly what I needed. And I found that in a professor in college. There are other people who are totally turned off by that. Like, they fled. They wanted nothing to do with it. And that just did not work for them. So I would say that, everybody's different. And it's, like, this tough love, soft love dichotomy. it's very, very hard. Like going back to Tal Ben-Shahar, that we've talked about Tal Ben-Shahar several times, but you know, you always need to have, we've talked about this, a board. Jim Collins calls it the council. You know, it's like the people that you trust who you will say, like, yes, please criticize me. And so in the end, like, it does have to come from you, but you do have to be open to the fact that you may be wrong, and, you know, you're willing to hear other people, but in the end you do have to make your decision. But all I'm trying to say is that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution for the execution problem.
Yeah. And I guess I would agree with that. I was speaking in general terms, and that's what I came up with.
Mike, you've been quiet.
Yeah, I wish I had something more valuable to say. Definitely a question, you know, that resounds, this thing of execution, but...
I mean, I still have a problem with it. Do you guys have a problem with it?
Oh, yeah.
Big time.
And I think, you know, when I see myself executing, it's just, for me, it's negative private speech. We've talked about this. It's like, you lazy, you know, like, look at what you have and look at how you're spending your time, and you will. And it's just like brute force will pushing me with negative private speech. That's what works for me.
See, one of the things that I guess, and this is kind of perhaps switching gears, I don't know that we should do that so late in the show, or maybe this will be a thing that we can later go to, but, you know, having negative speech and, you know, such things that you're saying, like, look at what you have, you know, and I think that's a very important thing, you know. I try to be thankful, you know, before I eat, before a meal. You know, maybe that was just something I picked up when I was younger, but recently has come back to me. In any case, you know, looking around at different people, I feel if you have your own speech, you know, a lot of times you may be using that speech when you're internalizing what another character in your life is, you know, and how they're interpreting or the people around you. And I don't know that it's always beneficial, you know, to take that speech, that private speech with you, to introduce it and implement it on another person's character based on a particular experience you have with them or something that they say or a series of things that they do. In my opinion, at least right now in this room at this hour, my feeling is that when you, you know, when you implement that thinking towards them, you're only reinforcing what it is that's negative about them. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But in any case, I just wanted to point that out. I don't know that it would be tough love. It's almost like an energy thing, you know. Provided that I think a person's a certain way and lacks a serious amount of value. You know, and that all I'm doing is I'm just reinforcing it when I'm thinking about it, when I'm interacting with them,
sure.
And I'm almost disgusted, you know, sometimes with some people's actions and the things that they say.
Right.
At the same time, you know, I don't want to go talk crap about CMU, but I guess I will.
Good, there's only 2 minutes left, so it'll be cut off.
this could go on for a while. But in any case, we produce a lot of teachers out of CMU, given the ratio of students we have and the number of teachers that are coming out of here, certified teachers. Taking in a couple education classes, thinking about being a teacher myself, I was very turned off from the program. And also just when I interact with a lot of the people that are going to become teachers, you know, and ask, so what, you know, what drives you to be a teacher? Well, I get weekends off. I'm pretty much guaranteed a job. Tenure, I have this job security, you know, all these reasons that seem so external and far removed from the teaching position that it's, you know, for me it's disgusting, you know, but at the same time, you know, is it bad for me to go ahead and voice that to them, or is it bad for me to be like always thinking about, you know, that when I'm interacting with that person? You know, I don't think that's for my the way I want to be is this, you know, judger of what is right and wrong amongst people. You know, so I don't know. It's just a thought, and perhaps we can go on to it into the next show because we have about 60 seconds left. But I think in this show that we said that thought experiments are kind of on this spectrum with practical deliberation, and although they may be far removed in some sense and not have a lot of value, there's other cases where thought experiments can be useful. I mean, is that a fair idea, guys?
Sure.
Indeed.
Okay, well, this has been Ethics Talk. Thank you for listening, and good night.
Night.